Well, this week we're looking at the Vedanta tradition, which is very different from the yoga tradition that we've looked at, although it does incorporate elements of yoga, because it's a tradition of much more sort of a philosophical speculation and meditation on scripture itself, rather than focusing on the actual processes of awareness. And it's terribly important, the text is terribly important in this tradition, and the centrality of a revealed text and its interpretation by the Brahminical tradition. And there's a great emphasis on the old, on the ancient, and non-originality is managed through different interpretative strategies. So it's a great virtue to be non-original. Well, in all Indian traditions, really. So all innovative thinkers like Abhinavagupta or someone will always say that they're actually not saying anything new. It's all been said before. They're just clarifying or elucidating revealed knowledge. And liberation is the stated goal of philosophical traditions in the Vedanta tradition. It's difficult to know to what extent that they mean it, and to what extent that's just a sort of a trope that they just utter at the beginning of their philosophical arguments. And so to understand soteriology in Indian traditions, we've got to look at Vedanta. So that's what we're going to do today. So literally, what does it mean? It means the end of the Veda, and it refers to the Upanishads. It became very popular in the West with Christopher Isherwood and Aldous Huxley and so on. And is often, and amongst sort of middle class Hindus today, is often taken to be Hinduism, the sort of philosophical expression of Hinduism as such.
Hence the Vedanta movement,
yeah,
which is quite popular in the eyes of upper middle society as representing the whole of Hinduism.
That's right, yeah. And the Ramakrishna Society. As well. Right, that's one of my speakers. Now there are two main philosophical sort of trajectories. One is non-dualism, I suppose, and one is dualism. And the Vedanta tradition oscillates between these two metaphysical systems. Divided into two sections, the Purva Mimamsa and the Uttara Mimamsa. And the Uttara Mimamsa is the one that's become most popular, as it were, or most well known. The Mimamsa means interpretation of something. It comes from a root man to think. So it's an exegesis, it's a tradition of exegesis. So the Vedanta tradition, which often gets associated with experience later on, is actually more concerned with interpretation and experience as such, in the way that you could say the yoga tradition is more concerned with experience than textual interpretation. The Vedanta tradition is the opposite. And it begins with the sutras of Jaimini, who's about 200 BC. And it begins, Atato Dharma Jignyasa, now the inquiry into Dharma. So Dharma is the main focus of inquiry. And what does it mean? So as opposed to the Vedanta Sutra, which we'll look at later, which is Atato Brahma Jignyasa, the inquiry into the Absolute, the Purva Mimamsa begins with the inquiry into Dharma as a foundation of all human sociality and indeed the foundation of the world. And so it's the most orthodox of orthodox in intellectual traditions. It emphasizes the interpretation of scripture, and it emphasizes taking scripture, reading it very carefully, and understanding it deeply, and doing what it says, above all doing what it says. So what's scripture all about? It's all about injunction, vidhi, do this and don't do that. and the injunction is particularly to ritual action. And why should you do this and not do that? You do this and don't do that because it says so in the Veda, because it's revealed scripture. It also becomes very interested later on in language and what this injunctive language means. And so it begins to speculate upon the meaning of the gods, for example, in the texts. And so there's one later Mimamsaka Kautsa, for example, who's a precursor of Fritz Stahl, who says that actually the gods in the text are just terms in language. They're terms within the text itself. Kautsa.
Ah.
But they're very interested in language, and they develop a very strong philosophical position, and they clarify their position because they're arguing with the Buddhists and they're arguing with the other schools as well. So injunction vidi is the most important thing, which actually accords with that. There's that French thinker Girard, René Girard, who says religion has nothing to do with narrative, it's all about prohibition. Do this and don't do that. So it's certainly true of the Mimamsakas. And they have a doctrine of apurva, which is something like karma, but it's a kind of energy or force, particularly of ritual action, particularly of the sacrifice, that has effects later on. Now, one of the consequences of the sacrifice is that the sacrificer goes to heaven. But you don't do it to go to heaven. You do it to because it says so in the Veda, because it's injunctive. But that shouldn't be your motivation for performing the rituals. So this doctrine of apurva, it's like, how do they account then for an action done here in this world, sacrifice? How can that have consequences later on? What's the connection between this action at time A and the later action at time C? And they said there's this invisible power, this apurva, which carries the consequences of actions into the future, beyond this life. So
what
a kind of
actually is therefore apurva? Have they defined it anymore? I mean, is it a spirit? Is it a spiritual power that's impersonal? Does it have a phenomenological form of some sort?
Yeah, it'd be like a, I think it's like
a moral power,
like a moral or
spiritual
power.
Is it the product? Is it the same as the product?
The product.
No,
it's a Prarabdha Karma, yeah, it's a different concept from the Mimamsakas.
Okay.
Yeah, it's, yeah.
Okay. Is the sum total of your actions or possibly a record of your actions which actually gives you fruit in the...
Yeah, something like that, that's right. It's a kind of record. So it's, if you like, you
it's
do an action...
Because
here's the world. I should chuck these away, shouldn't I? Here's the world. And you do an action here, and then the sacrifice, ritual sacrifice, and it has this kind of, and it affects this kind of electricity, or if you like, up here, which then has consequences in a later time. So that's kind of a purva.
Yeah.
It's a very similar concept to karma, but they developed it with particular with regards to ritual action. How can you sacrifice? How can that have effects later on? What's the relation between killing an animal in a Vedic sacrifice now and consequences later on? And it's accounted for by apurva, by this kind of electricity. Power, magical power of some kind, I guess. And the notable thing about the Mimamsakas is that they're realists and pluralists. So sometimes the Vedanta tradition is associated with monism and non-dualism, and that the world is illusion. The Mimamsakas are not like that. They're very strong realists and pluralists. So the plurality of the world is real and materiality is real, and that's where you begin from. And they divide the texts. Their main interpretative strategy is to divide the text into sections about action, karma, karmakanda, and sections about knowledge, jnanakanda. And the Purva Mimamsakas emphasize that actually the karmakanda is the most important sections of the Veda. So the Upanishads are merely elaboration and that they're not that important. But what's important is the ritual injunction, what you do and what you don't do.
So Vedic texts already mention karma.
The word karma occurs in the Vedic text.
In the Vedic text.
Where it means action, ritual action.
So is that in Upanishad?
In the Upanishads, the word karma gets extended to mean any action which has ethical consequences. So there's a shift. At first, a karma is an action, a ritual action.
Yeah.
So then the semantic range of that gets extended.
So in this context, it's a ritual.
Yeah,
ritual
action. That's right, ritual action. Yeah.
So it's different from what we learned like in Upanishad.
It starts quite narrowly to mean ritual action, like kriya, and gets extended to mean all ethical action, all action has ethical significance. I'm not sure if it means literally all action. So if not, who you're sitting next to probably isn't karma, but if you marry them, it would be. But it means ritual action. So when your detachment from action in the Upanishads is detachment from ritual action initially as well. So it's saying you don't perform ritual actions, that doesn't get you liberated, you become detached from actions. And then it gets extended to mean all actions.
Oh.
But originally it means ritual actions, you desist from doing rituals. Because knowledge, jnana, is more important than action. And this distinction actually pervades later traditions in the what's more important, action or knowledge. How do you get liberated, through action or through knowledge? And certainly in the Shaiva traditions, you get the Shaiva Siddhanta, which says action that gets you liberated, and Kashmiri Shaivas say no, it's jnana and knowledge, as we'll see next time. Now the problem is, what's the relation between these two kinds of Vedic text? The Mimamsaka said that action sections were most important, and the later Vedanta that the knowledge sections were most important. So really it depends on your metaphysics and your understanding of the world. So that's the problem with Mimamsaka. There were two, I'm not going to go into all this now because I want to look at Shankara, but there were two main schools, Prabhakara and Kumarila. And the later Vedanta tradition must be seen in reaction to these schools, really. Discuss questions of agency and free will and that kind of thing. So it's generally an atheistic system. Not all the Mimamsakas were atheists, but it was an atheistic system, and it's pluralist and realist. And it has the idea that the Veda has no human authorship, aparushya, and it is eternal, and it's received by the Vedic sages, like radio waves, if you like, and communicated to human beings. So it's atheistic, it's... pluralist and realist.
Is this Sankara and non-dualism?
This is Purva Mimamsa, just summarizing.
So it's atheistic, and
the Veda has no author. It's a strange doctrine in a sense, because the Veda is authorless. It has no author, but the Veda has no beginning and has no end.
So it's no God. Is that God or?
There's no God.
There's no God.
No.
According to Mimamsa, no God.
So there's no creator, as it were. But the Veda is nevertheless beginningless. So it's always been there and always will be there, and it's received by the sages. And you perform the actions that it tells you, because why would you do that? Simply because it's its own authority. It has no justification outside of itself. It's its own self-justification, its own authority. And that this doctrine, it tells you how to live as well, and that the whole of society is based on the Veda, for the Mimamsakas. And so it's a sort of argument for the status quo. It's quite a sort of politically conservative sort of doctrine, really. But they developed very interesting categories and strategies for the interpretation of texts. and well, it's Hindu hermeneutics, really. There are still Mimamsakas around today, but Laurie Patton was talking about them a couple of years ago. But the doctrine that there is only one substance in the universe is the alternative doctrine to the Purva Mimamsa, which you find occurring in the Upanishads, the Jnana Kanda sections of the Vedas. And that becomes terribly important in later traditions, and very often people associate Hinduism with that doctrine. So it pervades the Ramakrishna later on, Vivekananda, even right down to TM. Old Maharishi died a few days ago, I remember reading. So it sometimes becomes identified with Hinduism as such. Now, this non-dualism, then, is a doctrine that there's only one reality or substance in the universe, which is both beyond the universe, the material universe, and it pervades it. And there's a conceptual distinction, I think, between what might be called a philosophy of being and a philosophy of emanation or manifestation. And often these two get collided or together. And it's very difficult to separate them out. I mean, they're analytically distinct, I think, but the actual tradition itself often doesn't make the separation. So you've got a philosophy of being, which is pure immanence, if you like. There's only one substance, one reality that you have to wake up to. And there's a philosophy of emanation, but the world is an emanation or manifestation of this power, of some higher power. And that's implicitly cosmological. So the former is not cosmological, because there's only one reality in the universe. And the other is cosmological, so because it has implicit distinction within it. But these distinctions are not absolute, and there are grades of manifestation. And that's in traditions which speak of emanation or manifestation, you get a language of coagulation, solidification, shanata, these kinds of terms for the world as sweets are a coagulation of sugar cane juice, so the world is a coagulation of the absolute, that kind of language and image. So there's a conceptual distinction between those, and it's very difficult to maintain, as we'll see, a consistent philosophy of being, a consistent language of pure non-dualism, because language itself is dualistic, and Shankara, for example, recognizes this. And when he says, how can there be knowledge of the absolute? Because knowledge of entails a distinction between subject and object. So that leads into a language of ineffability. Actually, you can't say anything about this non-dual reality. But directly you start trying to speak about this non-dual reality, you're in a language which entails some kind of dualism. So later on, Abhinavagupta tries to maintain a philosophy of being in some of his writings, and it's very difficult. How can there be the distinction between purity and impurity, that kind of language you get? Where can the mind go that is not Shiva? And then on the other hand, you get this other language of there's a pure higher world and there's a lower world here which is more impure. So you get both together, and I don't think it's a contradiction. I think it's just different ways of speaking, different kind of language games, if you like. Now, all appearance, according to non-dualism, is identical with a unitary reality. And the earliest expression of this idea is in the Upanishads, which implicitly opposes the dualism of Samkhya and implicitly imposes the impersonalism of the Buddhists, if you like, if you want to call it that, the doctrine of Buddhism, the no-self doctrine of Buddhism. So if you like it, that sort of 500 BC, about then, 400, let's go a bit later, 400 BC to 300 BC, you've got a doctrine, three main philosophical positions, I suppose. You've got the Buddhists, you've got the Samkhya dualists, and you've got the Vedantic non-dualists. And they're all sort of variations of those. And they lay the grounding for the later development of the later traditions of the Darshanas and so on. Now, Samkhya dualists, the language of the Samkhya dualists pervades the Upanishads, and it sits on top of the other way around, I suppose, the non-dualist language sits on top of that Samkhya language. And with all the Samkhya, it adapts it into itself. So Samkhya becomes a kind of emanation, it becomes an emanationist or manifestation doctrine rather than a pure philosophy of being. But all of these doctrines, all of these metaphysical positions, the Samkhya dualists, the Buddhist impersonalists, and the Vedanta monists, share a denial of the first person as ultimately real. When I say, I do, I want, I sacrifice, that is ultimately not real. That ahamkara, that I-maker, is a lower level of emanation, or it's actually an illusion. For the Buddhist, it's unreal because it can be deconstructed into various components. For the monistic Upanishad, for the Upanishadic monist, it's unreal because it's marking a distinction which doesn't exist, which is illusory, because there's only one substance in the universe. And for the Samkhya dualists, when I say I sacrifice, it's not the Purusha, it's not the true self that's speaking, but the Ahamkara, the lower level, the lower tattva, which is within matter, inscribed within matter. So for all of them, the first person is unreal. Which is very interesting, really, because it's not a Cartesian cogito that's being affirmed.
So Buddhism also don't talk about the non-dualism, or in this context?
I'm not that familiar, but I don't think that the Buddhists use that kind of language very much, of non-dualism. Not the Theravada tradition.
Oh, not the Theravada tradition.
I don't think
it's here means the Theravada tradition. Mahayana.
Yeah, also even Mahayana, because the Purva Mimamsa were arguing against the Mimamsakas. The Buddhist Mahayana tradition, like Dharmakirti, Chandrakirti, and these people. Sorry, what was your question? I didn't think I answered it.
No,
really.
The question is like you said, the Vedanta here is like a present, like a non-dualist. Like a thought, and then Buddhism represent
yes.
In person. But I just wonder whether Buddhism also like contains like a non-dualism.
Oh, it does. Later Mahayana does.
Yeah.
So it means
from Theravada tradition.
Yeah, I think. I was really meaning the Theravada, the Hinayana. I suppose I was really meaning when there's an explicit denial of a self. Except in one school.
So does that later Mahayana like movement with the contents about the non-dualism has anything to do with Vedanta?
I think it's the other way around. I think the later Vedanta has a lot to do with the influence of Mahayana Buddhism. So within Mahayana you get a language developing of non-dualism really. But they don't use those terms very much. The Lankavatara Sutra I think uses non-dualism.
So you think the other means...
I think it's more influence of Buddhism on the
Buddhism
Vedanta.
Influence on Vedanta, then. But in this stage, we are talking about...
And the Upanishads, there's influence of Buddhism on the Upanishads and the Yoga Sutras, as we've seen. But I think the Buddhists, when they talk about the non-dualism, they're defining themselves against the Upanishadic kind of monism, I suspect. But I don't think there's much... I don't know whether they don't mention the Buddhists, to my knowledge, the Upanishads. So I think that the Buddha never mentions the Upanishads. I think it's because he doesn't know about them, because they're composed in the central of India, if you like, and then the Buddhism is developing the Ganges plain, so there's quite a geographical distance between them, and he may not even know about the Upanishadic doctrines. I'm not sure.
So when you said these three ideas was happen. That happened during the 4th and the 3rd century
about,
BC.
If the Buddha dies about 400 BC, the earliest Upanishads are probably about 800 BC.
But the Buddha does speak of, criticize the Pancharatra ritualism?
He doesn't mention Pancharatra, I don't think.
He criticizes the Pancharatra ritualism, does he not?
He's against the Brahmanical ritualism, but I don't think he would... You wouldn't know about the Pancharatra as such, I wouldn't have thought. But certainly, so the real Brahmin is not the one who performs rituals in the correct way, but the one who's ethically upright and that kind of thing.
Okay.
So at that, say, about four, let's take 400 BC, just after the Buddha's death, say, you've got the main metaphysical positions are the impersonalism of the Buddha, who teaches this no self doctrine, the dualism of Samkhya, and the monism of the Upanishads, and the kind of metaphysical position. I suppose you've got a fourth position, actually, which is the Brahmanical ritualism, which is not articulated into a clear metaphysics, perhaps, but is beginning to be articulated through the Purva Mimamsa, I suppose. So perhaps you've got four. But they all share this denial of the first person as real, and that's what's quite interesting about them. Now, Shankara is probably the most famous non-dualist in the Vedanta tradition, whose dates of tradition is 788 to 820. And he was from Kerala, so he was probably a sort of early Malayalam speaker or something. He came from a small village in Kerala. He was an Ambudri Brahmin. Lots of legends about him. I've been to the village where he's supposed to be born, and there's absolutely nothing there. So he probably was born there, because it's no political significance at all, you know. So why would they mention this obscure place if he wasn't born there? There's a story of him bathing in the swimming in the river, and a crocodile. This is on skillful means, I think. A crocodile comes and half swallows him. And I can't remember the full story now, but his mother won't get him renounced. But the last, as he's being threatened by the crocodile, he says, "Mum, please let me become a renouncer," as he's being eaten. And she says, "Okay." And so, but then the crocodile lets him go, of course. But his mum can't go back on her word. So he becomes a renouncer. And he dies, according to the Shaivas, from an ulcer in his rectum, due to the evil magic of Abhinavagupta, which is odd because Abhinavagupta was only born a few hundred years afterwards. But he's associated with the revivalism of the Buddhists. He's associated with counteracting a revival of Buddhism. So he's against the Buddhists, vehemently against Buddhism. And many of his doctrines are very close to Buddhism, Mahayana Buddhism. So it's interesting that he should be so vehemently rhetorical against them. Now, what are the texts of Shankara? It's Paul Hackerham and Mayeda Singaku have studied his works attributed to Shankara, and they've concluded there are four groups of texts can be attributed to him. There's a commentary, the commentary in the Brahma Sutras, commentaries on the Upanishads, namely the Brihadaranyaka and the Taittiriya, a commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, and an independent work, the Upadesha Sahasri. And they exclude various hymns attributed to Shankara. So he couldn't have written everything that is attributed to him, because it would be impossible for any human being to do that. But he probably was the author of those four texts, according to Mayeda and Hacker. So whoever Shankara was, I think we could take him, whoever is the author of the commentary on the Brahma Sutra, if we take that person to be called Shankara, then that's who we're dealing with. But on the other hand, it's not impossible that Shankara did write some of these hymns attributed to him. Because you're a philosopher writing commentaries doesn't mean to say that you're also not devotional, and he probably was an extremely devout character who may well have written hymns to the goddess. And he's said to have founded the Dashanamis, the four mats, the four monastic orders in four corners of India. Badrinath, Dwarka, Puri, Sringeri, and later on Kanchipuram, which claims to be derived from Shankara. And it had a strong influence on the later tradition, the tantric tradition called the Sri Vidya, which is sort of middle-class tantrism in South India now, respectable tantrism in South India. Now, there's an interesting book by Matthew Clark, came out a couple of years ago, who shows that the Dashanamas were actually only came into existence about the 17th or 6th, no, perhaps a bit earlier, between the 15th and 6th, 17th centuries. And it was in response to some political dimensions in Varanasi and patronage, royal patronage. And the naked ascetics who were defending the Dharma against foreign rule.
You said which century?
I can't remember Matthew Clark's argument, but it's between the 15th century and the 17th century, no earlier than the 15th century. But it's a really interesting argument in that book. I can't remember the precise title, but Matthew Clark is where to look for that. So these are fairly late developments. So, and also indicates a sort of unit, because I mean, if Shankara found these traditions, it's looking towards a sort of united kind of, not Hinduism as such, but an idea of some united coherence. You've got the four corners of India, and they all participate and share in this common ideal. Now, if Shankara didn't found those mathas, those orders, it pushes the whole idea of a united or unitary Hindu tradition much later. Now, the philosophy of Shankara is that there's spiritual ignorance, avidya or illusion, maya, caused by superimposition of what is not the self onto the self, adhyasa. And all knowledge is distorted by this superimposition, by this adhyasa. And this superimposition of what is not the self onto the self prevents us from seeing ourselves, the Atman, the true self, and prevents us from seeing that it's identical with an absolute power, an absolute Brahman. And to realize this, we need to develop discrimination, or to distinguish the self from what is not the self. And the opening passage on the Brahma Sutra commentary says this, which you've got in front of you, which is Thibaut's translation. It is a matter of fact that the object and subject, whose respective spheres as the notion of you and the I, and which are opposed to each other as much as darkness and light, cannot be identified, nor can their respective attributes. Hence it follows that it is wrong to superimpose upon the subject, whose nature is awareness, chit, and which has for its sphere the notion of I, the object and its attributes, whose sphere is the notion of the not I, and vice versa. It is wrong to superimpose the subject and its attributes onto the object. So that kind of superimposition is the problem. If you stop that superimposition, you see things as they are. Yata bhutam. So the removal of superimposition is the removal of ignorance, and the realization of the self is the realization of the witnessing subject, which is identical with Brahman. Now, that passage is quite interesting, but it also assumes that you've got two things there. You've got a subject and an object, and one superimposed on the other. Now, what's the status of the superimposition itself? And, or in other words, whose is ignorance? And that was a problem that later traditions criticised Shankara for. And if one person gets liberated, why doesn't everybody get liberated if there's just one being? If one person gets liberated and there's only one of us, all of us should be liberated. But, I mean, one rejoinder to that is that, well, actually we are. We're all liberated. We just don't know it. We just have to lift the veil of ignorance to see that we're liberated. So ignorance then arises from this limited consciousness which projects unreal distinctions such as between self and not self. So that's the basic metaphysical position which he justifies through the interpretation of scripture. And his enterprise, his purpose, is to show that his Advaita, his non-dual interpretation of sacred scripture, is correct. So he's an exegesis in the Mimamsaka tradition. And this is more important than mystical experience, anubhava. the correct exegesis, the correct, the non-dual, the Advaita interpretation of scripture is primary. And there's no reference at all in Shankara's works to personal religious experience. He does use the word anubhava, brahmanubhava, the experience of the absolute, and he identifies that with jivanmukti, liberation in life. But unlike some other thinkers, he doesn't refer to himself. It could be humility, but it could be that he's just not interested, he's more interested in the exegesis of scripture. Because, and again, the Veda for him is not of human authorship, and so experience in that text is irrelevant, because you don't have experience in that text, because it's of non-human authorship. It's not about humans. Well, it is about humans, but it's not. Human experience is not particularly important in it, as long as you do what the text says. And interpretation is important. Now, what's interpretation? For Shankara, interpretation is hearing, shravana, thinking, manana, and meditating, nididhyasana, on the text itself. So it's you see here, it's different from the yogic tradition, which emphasizes the focusing on a single point, on the breath or something like that, or an object of consciousness. So it's meditation in a different, very different kind of sense. It's hearing the text, contemplating or thinking about it, and meditating on the meaning of the text. So it's not about focusing concentration on a single point. It's a different kind of enterprise here. So it's much more in line with the scholastic tradition of in the West. Contemplation, meditation in that sense. And realization through hearing, thinking, and meditating. Knowledge and action sections of the text that Shankara talks about, the difference with Mimamsa is that knowledge is superior. So the Mimamsa said action is superior, Shankara says, oh no, it's knowledge is superior. Only knowledge can liberate a person, not action. A silver is suddenly seen to be shell or a snake or rope. So you're walking along the beach and you see money, you pick it up, you find it's shells. So that's sudden recognition. Or you see a rope in the snake in the corner of the house and you realise it's a rope. So that's knowledge, that's cognition. Only cognition or knowledge can make you liberated, can make you see things as they are. An action is different from knowledge. To milk a cow, says Shankara, takes effort, but to know a cow takes no effort. So to know the absolute takes no effort, because it's knowledge. And how do you, what is this knowledge? This knowledge is contained in the great sayings, the Mahavakyas, I am the absolute, Aham Brahmasmi, this self is indeed the absolute, everything is indeed the absolute, and you are that, Tattvamasi. So the great sayings of the Upanishads are what you have to existentially realize in yourself. And Shankara argues for the superiority of the Jnanakanda on the basis that liberation, unlike heaven, is not a thing that can be achieved. So you can attain heaven through action, but liberation is beyond heaven, and liberation can't be achieved through action because it's not a thing. What is liberation then? And he offers various accounts of that. Liberation is not the result of an action. It's not like arriving at a place, he says. So, like heaven, it's like arriving at a place. And liberation isn't like arriving at a place. And it's not like dying, and it's not like losing consciousness. And it's not a future goal or state, because it's not a telos, it's not an object or a future thing, because it's here and now. Liberation only exists in the present. And it's timeless in a sense, it's outside of time. So liberation is a kind of state of consciousness, it's a state of the world, and it's defined negatively. It's not like arriving at a place, not like a further shore or something. And it's not an action, and it's not a belief, and it's nothing to do with language, it's outside of language. Avachya cannot be articulated, cannot be expressed, it's ineffable. And press further, his liberation is like what happens to the space inside a pot when the pot breaks. And Gaudapada, one of Shankara's, not his teacher, his grand teacher probably, says that there's no liberation. You get this kind of language happening. There's no in reality, there's no liberation, really. It's like what happens to the light reflected in a dirty mirror when it's cleaned. So we're all enlightened, we're all liberated. You have to wake up to it, and you get this kind of negative language that it's not like anything. It's not an action. It can't be expressed in language. So it's a kind of being. It's sat. It's a kind of knowing. It's jnana. And it's an experiencing of one's true self, is anubhava. And which is the realization that the self is the absolute. And that we're always liberated, we just don't know it. We just have to wake up to the fact that we're all liberated already. And knowing is not an action, and so unlike action, doesn't breed further karmic residues. If you know something, that doesn't lead to karmic consequences, whereas action does. Mandana Mishra, a disciple of Shankara, says that liberation can be achieved by meditation. If you meditate, you can achieve liberation. But Shankara says no. Meditation is an action. Meditation has no possible function. Liberation is not the result of an action, and so can't be reached through any activity. So if you meditate, if meditation is an action, how can meditation lead to liberation, says Shankara? You can meditate till you're blue in the face, but it won't get you liberated, because the only thing that gets you liberated is knowledge and recognition of the truth of the Mahavakyas. And liberation is realized through hearing the great sentences, that kind of sudden cognition, sudden recognition. But even the great sentences for Shankara are ultimately false. To maintain a consistent non-dualistic language, you'd have to say that even the Mahavakyas are ultimately false. Even though you could be liberated through hearing them, as you could be killed through fear of an illusory snake. You see a snake and it frightens you to death, but it's actually not a real snake. So the Mahavakyas can liberate you, even though they're not real. And that realization is ultimately Maya as well. So it's a difficult doctrine in a way, but Shankara tries to be consistently non-dualistic in this kind of language. There's some concession to Bhakti and a personal lord as a lower level of understanding, and he has to introduce two levels of understanding. As the Buddhists do, he probably gets this from the Madhyamikas, that there are two levels of truth. The realization of Brahman in essence beyond quality is nirguna, identical with the self, but also have there's a state in which you can speak of Brahman as having qualities, sat, chit, and ananda, being, consciousness, and bliss. So liberation is the goal. What happens at liberation? When avidya is removed, two or three kinds of actions are made inoperative. The residues stored up, which have not come to fruition in this life, lose their power like burned seeds. Actions still to be performed in this life no longer bind, and that's liberation in life, jivan mukti. So you've got these different kinds of karma that we've spoken about before. Prarabdha, which is the karma to be enacted in the present lifetime, which is an arrow already in flight, as it were. Sanchitta, karma stored up for later fruition. And agamin, karma which is created in the present lifetime, which will come to fruition in the future. And at Jivan Mukti, Prarabdha and Agamin are eradicated as seeds are burned up in a fire. So for the Jivan Mukta, one liberated in life, behaviour is no longer an action, because action needs desire. And a Jivan Mukta works out Prarabdha karma in this life and no longer acts. He simply unfolds Prarabdha karma. So he doesn't act, he's not an agent anymore if you're liberated. You're just unfolding the consequences of past actions. And now from the perspective of higher truth, the Paramartika, Satya, the Jivan Mukta is liberated and incapable of ordinary knowledge and action. But from a lower standpoint, the Avaharika, he is a renouncer, a world renouncer. And Shankara indeed identifies the last stage of life, if you remember the four stages of life, the last stage of life, with liberation, Jivan Mukti. Now, there's a moral problem with monism. R.C. Zainer, in his book Our Savage God, identifies this, which I may have mentioned before. But for Shankara, a Jivan Mukta can't act immorally, even though he's beyond Dharma. He's beyond Dharma. But he nevertheless cannot act immorally, i.e. cannot act against the Brahmanical institution. I mean, Zainer argues, if there's only one reality in the universe, whether you're nice to people, whether you kill them, makes no difference to the one reality. Have you read that, anybody? Has anyone read that? Our Savage God. Charles Manson was a mass murderer in the 60s. And Zainer says, well, if you adopt Shankara's doctrine, that's what you get at the end of it. You get a Charles Manson. Because you can't make moral distinctions between good and evil. He became obsessed with Charles Manson, Zainer did. He went to visit him in prison. And wrote this book, Our Savage God. He got back from visiting Charles Manson, and he's smoking his cigarette in his rooms in All Souls, and he fell asleep and caught fire to the place. Do you know the story? You can still see a hole. They've covered it up, but you still see the patch where the hole was. And he thought this was Manson's evil eye.
Can you use that excuse?
Yes. So, anyway, there are a few arguments. There's an argument there from the Brahma Sutra Bhashya, which I'll let you read in your own time. So, next week we'll be looking at some of the developments in the tantric traditions in Shaivism and the Pancharatra in the next 3 weeks.
Sorry, I can't be here next week.
That's okay.
Try and come the week after and catch up. Apologies.
Yeah, that's okay. Any questions or points? Or and Shankara?
I've got a question that has nothing to do with this, but just thinking back to the lecture on yoga, I don't know if you have any thoughts about some of the Western contemporary dualist interpretations of yoga, like Ian Richard wrote a book about the Yoga Sutras, is from like interviewing with the non-dualist perspective.
I think, I've read Ian's thing. I just can't see it myself. I can't see that it's he talks about the enlightenment of Prakriti and so on. It doesn't make sense to me, most of it. It seems that the Yoga Sutras are dualistic, and the metaphysical backdrop is indeed. You can have a monistic interpretation, as Shankara's commentary is in evidence, but I don't think the original tradition was
Is Ian
Mishra
sort of on his own?
I think he is. Well, he's not on his own in the sense that there's a whole Vedanta tradition thinks that. The later Vedanta tradition thinks that actually, yes, yoga is all about Buddhism. So Ian's not alone in that. But it's I don't think that's the interpretation of the yoga tradition itself.
There's a book in the I can't remember who it's by in the Hindu Studies book series, but someone who tries to do Sankhya as a kind of metaphysics of experience, who then tries to take Sankhya and Yoga and turn it into some sort of phenomenology, effectively, where Prakriti is. Because there is this funny thing with Prakriti, it's not clear whether it's matter exactly or how to see it.
Nature. Mikkel Burley.
That's right.
Actually, there's a good critique of Ian's work in that book.
Okay.
Mikkel Burley. Called Samkhya. What's it called? Samkhya Yoga and Samkhya. Something like that. Classical Yoga and Samkhya.
Yeah.
In which he demonstrates that yoga is indeed has a dualistic metaphysics.
Number 4, please.
So, see you next week, some of you.